This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Futuro.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the wrongful incarceration of J.J. Velasquez in jail for 22 years for a crime the evidence suggests he did not commit. I'm here in the virtual studio with producer Maggie Freeling, which means that both of us are recording from home. You might remember Maggie because she's been a part of our team at Latino USA and Futuro for several years now. Today, Maggie is here to bring us her latest project. Hey, Maggie.
Hey, Maria. I am so glad to be back with you.
So the name of your new podcast series is called Unjust and Unsolved. And well, okay, Maggie, I'm super intrigued. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So as you know, I left Futuro in April to start my own project, Unjust and Unsolved, and it's about wrongful convictions. And of course, when you wrongfully incarcerate somebody, it goes into these now unsolved crimes.
All right, Maggie. So tell us specifically about this episode and this story.
Yeah. So this episode is about John Adrian Velasquez, or JJ, as his friends call him. And JJ was really one of the first people I talked to for this project. I was, you know, we're in New York, we worked in Harlem. And so I was just Googling New York wrongful convictions, and JJ popped up. And I was really drawn to this case because it took place down the street from the Futuro offices. So to me, this was like, wow, I have to get in touch with this man. So basically what happened is on the afternoon of January 28th, 1998, retired NYPD officer Albert Ward was shot dead in Harlem, New York, right down the street from us. And really, there was no physical evidence at the scene. JJ had an alibi. And then the description from witnesses at the scene, they described somebody that does not look like JJ at all. So JJ gets called to the station, you know, thinking, I'll clear this up in a few minutes. I'll enter a lineup. I didn't do this. He winds up being identified, arrested, sentenced to 25 to life. He's been in prison for 22 years for a crime that all of the evidence suggests he did not commit.
Wow. I mean, this is extraordinary, Maggie. And I mean, what's crazy is that you didn't really have to search so hard to find this story. So tell us a little bit more specifically, because like there have been some eyewitnesses, right, that have been part of what's been going on with his case.
Yeah. So one of the major things in JJ's case is the entire reason he was even brought to the station, entered a lineup, is because, you know, there are these witnesses who mentioned that JJ looked like the shooter. Turns out these witnesses later have recanted, said they were coerced by the police. JJ really had nothing to do with it. They didn't even know who he was. They kind of just wanted to get out of the police station, pointed to a photo, and that's how JJ wound up in prison for 22 years.
So you've been visiting. How have you been in touch with JJ? And where is he?
Yeah, so I got in touch with JJ actually almost about a year ago at Thanksgiving. I reached out to him, and he is in Sing Sing, just about an hour outside of the city. So I was able to go visit him in February, right before the pandemic broke out, right before we went on lockdown. Prisons are not allowing any visitors. They haven't for 8 months. So I was really fortunate that I got to see JJ. He's been the only person I can visit in prison. And Maria, as you know, it's just such a personal experience when you get to see somebody in real life and talk to them in real life. And because of that, I've gotten really close with JJ, and I now consider JJ a friend of mine.
So what's happening in terms of JJ's case? Because actually, we're airing this at the end of the year, and something could happen with JJ's case right now.
Yeah. So usually at the end of each year, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo grants clemency to somebody. And JJ currently has an application for clemency on Cuomo's desk. This is his third year in a row applying for clemency. And this year, JJ has a really great shot. And so I want to say off the bat that I am asking listeners, if they feel compelled by JJ's story, to email Governor Cuomo urgently. There's just a few days before the end of the year, telling him that they believe in JJ's innocence and to grant this man clemency. And I just want to say, full disclosure, I also wrote a letter of support for JJ's clemency that also went to Andrew Cuomo.
So Maggie, I've known you for quite a while as a journalist and then as a friend. You don't usually say those kinds of things, like go ahead and email somebody and rally behind their pitch for clemency. You really believe in this case strongly.
I mean, absolutely. When you listen to the episode, you'll hear, I mean, JJ was in the Bronx. He wasn't there. Witnesses have recanted. Maria, as you know, sometimes you look into these things and the evidence is just so overwhelming. I mean, NBC producer Dan Sleppy, and you'll hear him in the episode as well, he looked into JJ's case for 10 years. For 10 years, he was investigating, talking to witnesses before he did a Dateline special on it, talking about JJ's innocence. I mean, the evidence is so compelling and so overwhelming. JJ was born in Manhattan in 1975 to his mother, a union organizer, and his father, an Amtrak police officer. He lived in Brooklyn the first few years of his life, and eventually he landed in the Bronx at 16, where he lived and had a family until his incarceration. JJ was described as a fun-loving, popular guy.
Are we starting? Are we rolling?
We're rolling.
Yeah, okay. Just give me, I didn't know that we were.
Fine. That's totally
I'm
fine.
I'm kind of used to this stuff. Okay.
Yeah, you do a lot of media, don't you?
Yes, I do.
JJ is now 44. We're sitting at a table in an outdated conference room inside Sing Sing days before visitation was cut off because of COVID-19. Before JJ came in, they had him waiting over 2 hours in the freezing hallway for us because security took so long for us to get through. Sing Sing has a dark reputation for housing and executing some of society's most notorious criminals, including Albert Fish, serial killer, child rapist, and cannibal.
Long before Hannibal Lecter, fictional cannibal, there was a man the tabloids labeled both the Gray Man and the Werewolf of Wisteria. He was a true-life cannibal. A living monster.
The prison is almost 200 years old, built in 1825, and I have to say, it looks like it. Even though it's located in a beautiful town with a waterfront view on the Hudson River, the prison is ominous, dark, clammy, absolutely chilling. I'm shivering as I sit across from JJ, who told me it's actually warmer inside than usual.
Where would your life have gone? What were you doing? What were your hopes and dreams like before any of this became anything in your life?
Well, it's a good question. And I don't want to be disrespectful, but it doesn't even matter anymore. What I would have liked to be or who I would have liked to have been doesn't matter because that dream was shattered the minute I got arrested.
On the afternoon of January 28th, 1998, a man walks into an illegal underground gambling spot in Harlem, New York, on 125th and 8th Avenue. The spot was owned by retired NYPD officer Albert Ward. The man places his bet at the gambling spot on a piece of paper. He hands it in and then leaves. Shortly after, he returns with another man. And that's when witnesses report hearing something along the lines of, "This is a stick-up," or "Put him up." The men then bring about 6 people into the back room and tie them up. At this point, Officer Albert Ward tries to stop them. Evidence suggests Ward fired at the men first, who then fired back. Witnesses say it's possible Ward hit one of the men as they saw him stumbling at the top of the stairs on his way out. The bullet that struck Ward hit his face and killed him almost instantly. In a New York Times article from the next day, people who knew him describe Ward as a, quote, beautiful person. He grew up in the area and owned many shops and bars in the neighborhood, including a Baskin Robbins. A neighbor told the Times if someone needed money, he would help. And sometimes he even bought people clothes when they got out of prison. Ward was 59 when he was murdered. Afterwards, the NYPD put a BOLO, police speak for be on the lookout, for 2 suspects, a shooter and an accomplice. The accomplice was described as a dark-skinned black male. The shooter was described as a light-skinned black male with long braided hair or dreadlocks. At the same time, new father J.J. Velasquez was a 21-year-old living with his girlfriend and two young sons, John Adrian Jr. and Jacob. Jacob was just born a month prior to this incident.
So January 27th, 1998, where were you?
January 27th, 1998, I was actually on the phone with my mother. So January 28th is my father's birthday.
JJ told me at this same time Albert Ward was shot and killed, he was at his house in the Bronx, on the phone with his mom, discussing his father's birthday. His father had died 10 months prior. The following day was his birthday, and JJ wanted to go see his headstone.
Because they had just put up his stone, I never got to see his stone. And after that, we were going to go to the apartment and pray. And that turned out to be like a 74-minute conversation. And it just so happens, we didn't know this right away, because if you asked me where I was, you know, on any particular day during the time that they're talking about this crime commenced, I would tell you that I was home. But how do you prove that you're home? It wasn't until a couple of months in, while I'm on Rikers Island suffering, that my mother's like, listen, your lawyers found it. I said, found what? Found evidence that there's an alibi. We have proof that you were home. You were on the phone with me.
So it was phone records?
Yeah, it was phone records that they were able to find that substantiated the length of our conversation. And then it brought it all back. And it was like, wow.
So how did JJ wind up being identified as the shooter? It just so happened that JJ had been arrested a few months earlier for drug possession. He was never convicted, though. But police still had his mugshot on file. So when they interrogated witnesses in Ward's shooting, they showed them an array of mugshots that included JJ's picture. One witness said JJ looked like the guy, and that was it. Police sent word that they wanted to question JJ, and when JJ heard that, he voluntarily went to the police station to speak to them, thinking he'd clear this all up in just a few minutes.
Yeah, so I turned myself in February 2nd, 1998. Part of the reason why I turned myself in is because my father was a police officer who raised me to believe in a system. And to just think about how the system treated me. You know, my father served this country as a veteran in the Army, and then as a police officer when he came out of the Army. And this is what he gets as retirement benefits, that 10 months after he passes away, you set his son up.
This may be a tough question, but do you almost feel it was like a blessing that he died before you got locked up, before he could see this happen to you?
Actually, I've never looked at it like that. It's interesting that you would say that. But I think it's the opposite. I believe that if my father was alive, this couldn't have happened to me. I believe that my father as a standing police officer would have granted a lot more respect and would have said, you can't do this to my son.
The eyewitness who chose JJ's mugshot was a man named Augustus Brown. Brown says that he only saw the shooter for a few seconds, but he felt pressure to pick someone out of the stack of mugshots police showed him because if he didn't, he says the police told him they would pin it on him. Here's an interview with Augustus Brown with Dateline.
He told us detectives were pointing the finger at him as a suspect.
They threatened to charge me with conspiracy to this, saying that I met him.
So the police were going to say you were part of this robbery?
Yes, saying that I set this up for them to come in and rob it.
Right. Which you didn't do.
No. And me having that on my record, they, young black man, I ain't got no job. I'm not in school enough.
Right.
So that's what came about me pointing the finger at somebody.
If that's true, Velasquez's lawyers say his testimony cannot be believed.
So Brown said the police were going to pin the murder on him if he did not point the finger at someone else. Brown was also a drug dealer and had 10 bags of heroin on him when he was brought in for questioning, so he thought he would go down for that too. The 20-year-old was terrified of the threats and going down for the murder, so he pointed at JJ, said he thought he might have recognized JJ as someone from the neighborhood. And that was that. He picked him as the shooter. That's when JJ was contacted. Once at the precinct, the police asked JJ if he would enter a lineup, which, knowing he was innocent, he agreed to.
I walked into a precinct and volunteered for a lineup against my lawyer's, advice. He said, just go home. let them do their job and then we'll do ours. And I said, no, I didn't do this. I'm going in that lineup. If I go in that lineup and I don't get picked, I'm free, right? He said, yeah. But if you get picked, you're going to jail. I said, I'm going in that lineup. And that was the last choice I made as a free man.
JJ is a light-skinned Latino male. At the time, he had short hair and a very thin soul patch kind of mustache. Witnesses at the scene describe the shooter as a black male, light complexion. And maybe that doesn't seem like a huge jump from a light-skinned Latino, but the description went on to say the guy had a beard, mustache, goatee, and braids or dreadlocks. 8 of the 9 witnesses gave the same description. So a sketch was drawn and put on a wanted poster, and this sketch looks nothing like JJ. I mean, it's not even a close resemblance. Plus, 3 independent sources who saw the poster said the sketch was of a man named Mustafa.
This sketch was plastered all over Harlem, a place where the streets talk and the cops were listening. Tips came in from all directions, but one name kept coming up over and over again, Mustafa.
Remember, the cops wanted 2 men, the shooter and the accomplice. The accomplice was the darker-skinned one. He was eventually identified as Derry Daniels. Daniels totally fits this profile. He had 14 prior arrests and 12 convictions for drugs, assault, and robbery. Daniels was charged with the murder of Albert Ward and eventually wound up pleading guilty to robbery. He was sentenced to 12 years. And it's worth noting, though, that Derry Daniels, in all of his dealings with police, never mentioned JJ as being involved in the crime. There's no evidence Daniels and JJ even knew each other. And more than that, Daniels' brother told a private investigator that JJ was indeed a stranger. His brother only implicated him to get a lesser sentence. This was the only time Derry Daniels implicated JJ, a year after the shooting, at his own sentencing. He didn't even testify at JJ's trial. When reporters tried to ask Daniels about JJ's claims of innocence after Daniels' release, because remember, he got out years ago thanks to that plea deal, he refused to talk about the case, period.
Me being here for this crime makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. No sense whatsoever. The physical descriptions do not match. The physical evidence is not there. Nothing makes sense.
The physical description was a light-skinned black male with dreads or braids.
Yes.
Hair that you did not have.
Absolutely.
You're not a light-skinned black male.
No.
How did this happen? How did you get here? How did you get here?
When we answer that, Maggie, I think I'll be leaving here. Unfortunately, that's a question I can't answer. I don't know how I got here.
So after Brown selected JJ, a chain of events happened. Now with an ID, the rest of the eyewitnesses who were at the underground gambling spot when Albert Ward was shot were asked to come in and view a lineup. This was the lineup JJ volunteered for. JJ was in the lineup, a light-skinned Latino male next to other filler men, none of whom were black or even remotely resembled the sketch that had been drawn of the shooter, a light-skinned black male with dreads. Actually, JJ says 2 of the guys looked like white men, which, if anything, would make JJ look darker than he was. I saw this picture, and it's true. JJ was then picked out by 2 other witnesses after one chose someone else first, and the other was unsure about their choice. Based on this, JJ was charged with the first-degree murder of Albert Ward, even though the only evidence police had was shaky eyewitness IDs. And make no mistake, eyewitness identification should always be second-guessed. The Innocence Project estimates that 71% of the nearly 400 wrongful convictions that have been overturned by DNA evidence involved mistaken eyewitness IDs. The brain is malleable and impressionable, and it is surprisingly easy for police to make subtle suggestions in mugshot spreads or suspect lineups to cause witnesses to finger the wrong person. But luckily, JJ had an alibi. Remember the 74-minute phone call with his mom that placed him at home at the time of the murder? Well, at trial, the prosecution brushed the record of this call off as just the girlfriend on the phone. JJ had proof someone had made a lengthy phone call from his house to his mom's that day, but there was no way to prove it was him. he was ultimately convicted of second-degree murder. JJ has been in prison ever since.
I've been fighting this conviction for all of 22 years. When you're innocent and you're fighting a case, you're at like the worst position to represent yourself. I don't know what happened. So now I have to go off of what they claim are facts. And I already know aren't the facts because you said that I did it. And that's wrong. So if we're starting from that, then what else is wrong in this picture? And how do I defend myself if I don't know what's right?
Coming up, if JJ is innocent, then who killed Officer Ward?
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hey, we're back. And today we're bringing you something quite special. It's the story of JJ Velasquez, told by producer Maggie Freeling as part of her new podcast, Unjust and Unsolved. Maggie is going to pick up the story now.
JJ has been fighting for his freedom from behind the walls of Sing Sing Maximum Security Correctional Facility since 1998. I'm here at Sing Sing with JJ, and he's telling me he's had a lot of time to think about what happened.
You know, when I first came through, I thought I was that anomaly. I thought I was like, how could this happen? You know, my father was a cop. I'm being accused of, you know, taking a cop's life. It doesn't make any sense. Putting innocent people in prison for crimes just so that they can say that there was some level of finality to it, right? So a cop was shot in broad daylight in Harlem, and somebody has to go to prison because we can't have people believing that people can just do this and get away with it. Yet Albert Ward's killer's still out there victimizing people. We have no idea how many victims have suffered as a result.
But new evidence and witness recantments could help him regain his freedom and figure out who the real killer of Albert Ward is. In 2004, JJ's legal team interviewed Augustus Brown while he was incarcerated at Rikers Island. Remember, Brown is the heroin dealer who picked out JJ's mugshot. Brown says he was actually high on drugs when he identified JJ and was high on drugs when he testified. He says he really wasn't sure who the shooter was, but was afraid to say anything because he thought the police would implicate him in the murder. So he had to stick with his story. Then another of the three witnesses who identified JJ also recanted in a sworn statement to JJ's lawyers, saying they too felt pressure by the police to pick someone out. The third expressed serious doubts about picking the right person and said he even testified against JJ, knowing what he was doing was wrong. But again, police pressure convinced him to testify. The lead detective in JJ's case was Joseph LaTrenta, and the lead prosecutor was Eugene Hurley. The case against JJ is also lacking any physical evidence. Witnesses say they believe Albert Ward shot and wounded the man with the gun. They say while fleeing, the shooter left a blood smear on the stairs. Tests from back then found the smear was not blood, but testing has evolved drastically since then. However, I work in Harlem, right next to the crime scene, and unfortunately, the building was demolished, so there's no chance of doing further testing on the smear. But regardless, JJ does not have a gunshot wound on him. Further, there's actual evidence pointing away from JJ, the betting slip, the piece of paper the shooter used to place his bet. Remember, this was a gambling spot. The slip was collected as evidence and was recently tested for touch DNA. A DNA mixture was found, and from the partial profiles the independent test found, they concluded that JJ's DNA was not on the slip. Since witnesses say the shooter placed a bet on this slip and JJ didn't touch it, it stands to reason JJ is not the shooter. So who did touch the slip? Who did kill Albert Ward? Unfortunately, at the moment, in New York State, touch DNA cannot be entered into CODIS, the national DNA database used by law enforcement to get a match. Because ironically, the worry is that it will convict innocent people since the profiles are partial. They're small. So the only thing it is good for right now is eliminating JJ. But that's not as easy as it sounds. With these kinds of cases, it's much easier to be convicted than freed. To be exonerated, it's likely law enforcement is going to want the real shooter. And as I mentioned earlier, three independent sources said the man's name was Mustafa. But any investigation into Mustafa seems to have been dropped as soon as Augustus Brown ID'd JJ in the photo array. However, there are credible leads as to who Mustafa is. Now, I don't want to name names in this podcast unless they are widely broadcast, which these names have not been. But JJ's website does list the names of these credible leads, including one name in particular, which was recently discovered in a police report that the prosecution never turned over to the defense.
Velasquez's lawyers announcing that 3 months ago, through a source, they received an old police report with information that proves his innocence. A police report they say was withheld by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office before the trial.
The newly discovered police report was mailed to NBC producer Dan Slepian.
My name is Dan Slepian. I'm a supervising producer at Dateline NBC, where I have worked for about 25 years.
Dan has covered many alleged wrongful conviction cases and has helped free five people with his reporting. He has been covering JJ's case for almost two decades now. He met JJ while visiting someone else he was covering in Sing Sing, and JJ also asked him to cover his case.
He, at that first meeting, challenged me to find him guilty. Don't try and prove me innocent, try and prove me guilty. And that kind of intrigued me. And so over the course of now 18 years, I've come to learn this case intimately. And, you know, I have been, people look at my work sometimes and say, you know, you're an advocate for the wrongfully convicted. I'm an advocate for the truth. And so when I look at the details of JJ's case, I can come to no other conclusion other than his innocence. He challenged me to investigate his case. I continued to be skeptical. I looked into it for nearly 10 years before I did a story for Dateline.
In 2012, Dan's investigation into JJ's case aired on Dateline. And afterwards, things completely changed.
It was after that, 15 years after I first heard about his case, after I produced a story for Dateline about it, I get in my mailbox at home this yellow envelope without a return address, with 40 police reports that had never been turned over to him unredacted. And to me, one of them was a bombshell.
This is the missing police report that changed JJ's case. It's an interview with JJ's alleged accomplice, Derry Daniels' father. Daniel's father said the night before the murder, his son, Derry, had a friend over the house.
He described the friend as a light-skinned black man with braids. This is the night before the murder. The next morning, when this robbery happened, nine eyewitnesses said the shooter was a light-skinned black man with braids.
If Daniel's father is right, this statement is exculpatory evidence Prosecutor Hurley did not hand over to the defense.
And what's amazing about that report, actually, is that the defense attorney, prior to JJ's trial, wrote a letter to the Manhattan District Assistant District Attorney who tried the case saying, we are missing 40 police reports. Please turn over these reports. And they list them. And the assistant district attorney takes the time to go through them and writes a letter back prior to trial saying, we've reviewed your request. These are the reports that you suggested. Police report number this, police report 64, police report 63, police 93. And takes the time to say, we're not handing these over because they're unimportant. They're not discoverable. We don't need to turn them over. There's no important information in here. And took the time to write on this, even on this one, police report number 93, interview with the co-defendant's father. We're not turning it over because that was up to the prosecutor because that's the power they have.
Not only would that have pointed away from JJ, but it could have helped finger Albert Ward's real killer, because that's what's at stake here. When someone goes to prison for a crime they didn't commit, it means they lose years of their life, sure, but it also means the real killer went free. And as far as JJ is concerned, withholding a statement like this is almost the same as planting a gun on somebody or coaxing a witness to lie. It is all designed to get a conviction, not the truth.
I am not an advocate for individual people. I am an advocate for the truth. All I care about is the truth. And unfortunately, what I've seen time and time and time again is that the system doesn't care about the truth.
And so, despite the roadblocks he's faced, today JJ has accomplished so much from the inside. And because of it, he's able to live in the prison's honor block, a small section of the prison with more privileges. JJ has a bachelor's degree in behavioral science. He's been in leadership positions for a number of committees, including the Family Reunion Program, the Youth Assistance Program. He's received a certificate of recognition for outstanding community service from a New York State senator. And he recently did a TEDx talk.
My name is John Adrian Velasquez. Friends and family tend to call me JJ. Feel free to do the same. I want to redefine what matters by talking about the powerful connection between better choices and better lives. This talk is not about me, my case, or my children. This talk is about us. This talk is about how we can come together collectively to overcome our trauma and turn it into triumph. This talk is about us and how we can invest in our future by raising the caliber of our communities. This talk is about us taking control of our lives and making choices matter.
At some point, you have to just separate what you're going through from reality. And I don't know how I was able to do it, but I had done it for a long time. But in the midst of that, I kind of lost myself, too. Like, I realized that I was, like, absent in my children's lives. Like, it was like, while we're on the visit, I'm playing a role that I'm all right in here, and everything is fine, and I'm asking you about school and everything else. But when I go back into that cage, I'm becoming the person that they're treating me like, which is an animal, you know? And it was hard to separate that. But my mother taught me something, and what she said was, you have to grow where you're planted, and it doesn't matter what they do to your body. You have to keep your mind healthy. And I really just start to look at my situation, and I kind of get lost. There's a couple of times where family have wondered, you know, where's JJ? I stop calling, I stop writing. But it's because I'm dealing with myself, and there's a lot of pain in there, and I don't want to share that pain.
Instead, he not only fights his own wrongful incarceration, but he fights for others too. He told me that when he first entered prison, he thought he was the only guy that was wrongfully convicted.
But as I came up and I started to meet people, I started to realize, wait a minute, this guy's innocent. And at first, you know, you would look at it and you would say, is he really innocent?
Well, that's the saying, right? Everyone in prison's innocent.
Right. But then you really start looking at it and saying, like, you know what? This is happening. And it happens at alarming rates. And I've been in facilities with 5 and 10 other innocent men. I would say that wrongful convictions is America's worst nightmare and possibly America's most heinous crime. How is it that you, as a member of law enforcement, can intentionally design a conviction of somebody who doesn't belong in prison? That is disgusting.
4 years ago, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office reinvestigated JJ's case with its Conviction Integrity Unit, and they decided there was not sufficient evidence to prove his innocence. But Dan Slepian doesn't buy this, because he said the unit allegedly reinvestigating did not even speak to JJ's alibi witnesses.
His mother and his girlfriend. If you're doing an objective review of a case, no matter who you are, don't you want to talk to everybody? Don't you want to talk to his alibi witnesses to see if they're lying? Why would they not talk to them? Is that a thorough reinvestigation not to talk to his alibi witnesses? If I was doing a story, I wouldn't be able to put it on the air. I can't do a story and say he told me why he's innocent, but I didn't go check out why he's guilty. Or here's why he's guilty, but I didn't check out why he's innocent. You check out everything. I was pretty surprised when I didn't see an interview with them. And I spoke to his mother and I called her. Said, were you ever interviewed by anybody from the Menendez office? She goes, no one ever called me. So it indicates to me, just based on the facts, not my opinion, not my emotion, just based on the facts, is that it indicates that there's some sort of bias if you're not interviewing people that are going to potentially be helpful to his side. When you look at an official record and it's in a court filing and a judge's order says the Manhattan District Attorney's Office did a thorough reinvestigation of the case and found no reason to disturb the conviction, that becomes findings of fact by law. The judge has said in the order, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office did a thorough reinvestigation, and therefore it is officially the truth. But if you scratch the surface a little bit, you realize, guess what? It's not exactly the truth. Their job is to find truth. It's not to protect convictions.
That unit has overturned 12 convictions in the past decade, only one of which was a murder case. 10 of those 12 convictions involved false accusations and perjury.
When you have a conviction integrity unit, as the name says, integrity unit, that says, we're going to take another look at this case. We're going to reinvestigate it. You would think that that body, that official authoritative body, is going to take an honest, objective, thorough look at the case. Not, is our conviction good? It's, who killed Albert Ward? And did this guy do it? I just have to say that this is a systemic issue. This is much bigger than the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. I mean, this is a systemic issue around the country. And I've been investigating cases of alleged wrongful convictions, claims of wrongful convictions for two decades. And each one of them that has merit has had the same hallmarks along the way when it comes to the resistance from prosecutors and the system and judges. That the system is not built to get people out. It's built to put people in and keep them there. A system that refuses to accept facts and reality.
JJ's legal team is pursuing multiple avenues to secure JJ's release, including a full reinvestigation into his case, including DNA testing, and they have a petition in front of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo for clemency. Governor Cuomo will be deciding before the end of the year, in just a few days, whether to grant JJ clemency. And I'm urging anyone who believes in JJ's innocence to email the governor's office ASAP. Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney, is up for re-election next year. It's unclear if he plans to run again, but many progressive contenders have tossed their hat in the ring. And a new DA could mean a new shot at freedom for JJ if he's not granted clemency, which he does have a strong shot at. So again, please email Governor Cuomo ASAP. JJ says when he gets out, he wants to help others in his situation.
They've actually convicted the wrong guy in too many different ways because I'm married to this movement. I can be exonerated tomorrow. They can give me millions of dollars the next week. And the next month, I will be in front of the next court helping the next wrongfully convicted man. That is my future now, and that's what matters. It doesn't matter who I was meant to be before, because I know who I'm meant to be now. And I'm on the front lines of this movement. I've helped three guys get out, right?
That, not to interrupt, but that is so crazy. You've helped three guys get out, and you are still here.
Yes. One of them just came to see me this week on Monday.
Who's that?
His name is Johnny Hincapié. And he did 25 years for a crime he didn't commit, the Roseland murder.
JJ says he himself also helped Eric Glisson and Richard Rosario overturn their wrongful convictions. Because, as he told me in one of his first letters to me, the fight against wrongful convictions is bigger than him. Because he's seen the lasting damage his incarceration has done to him and his family. And he doesn't want anyone else to suffer like they have.
I have two children.
Two sons. How old are they?
Wow. One is 25 now. The other one is 22. I left them when my oldest son, John Adrian Velasquez Jr., he was 3 years old. My youngest son had just been born a month prior to this.
Do they come visit you?
Yeah, not as much now. I mean, you know, they've grown and things have changed a lot. But the first half of their lives, my mother has brought them to see me every weekend. And it took me a long time to realize that I was depriving them of a childhood because they were spending 5 days in school and 1 day in prison. I'm not sure if people can imagine what it's like for the entire process of your family's life taking place in a visiting room within the boundaries of a small area that you have to just basically sit at a table like we are. And that's the basis of the life that you know with your own children. And they had to come to some type of realization, like, why can't my father touch money? Why can't my father come to this machine with me? Why can't my father come home with me? So it was very rough. That has rolled over and affected my family in devastating ways. A couple of times you asked me questions about, like, who was in the audience or who was at the court with when I went for my hearing. My oldest son wasn't at court. He was in a cage like me.
JJ's son was most recently arrested and convicted for burglary. He's currently serving his time at Cape Vincent in New York on the border of Ottawa, Canada, over 300 miles from JJ in Sing Sing.
And they say statistically that children of incarcerated parents are 7 times more likely to be incarcerated themselves. And my son has become a victim of that. And it happened because I was incarcerated for something that I didn't do. My other son, youngest son, thank God, he's never been arrested. But he walks around in society on eggshells thinking that incarceration is the family curse. You know, so the impact is unexplainable. And it has so many different layers of pain involved.
JJ's mother had a heart attack on what's called Wrongful Conviction Day, or October 2nd in 2018. JJ thinks it's connected with his conviction.
And she was diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, which in regular terms is broken down as broken heart syndrome. And I never thought that somebody's heart can be broken. But it's apparent that wrongful convictions has broken my mother's heart.
One of the hardest things when I came to see JJ was seeing the torment and sadness in his eyes. If you believe the evidence in this case, you believe his life was stolen.
When was the last time you felt a hug from somebody?
Because of a lack of that opportunity, we tend to hug each other in here when we embrace each other. Sometimes we have special events like the TEDx event, and, you know, I received a lot of hugs that day. And those are the special moments in our lives that we're able to really just feel human again.
Sure. That's good. No, that's okay.
I apologize
no,
for making it's you emotional. Okay.
If JJ doesn't get clemency this year, he's up for parole in 2022. He could show remorse for what he's accused of and admit to the crime and likely get out. But he's told me he's not about to do that.
So why not just say that to get out and fight for it on the outside?
It's not going to happen here. I can't do it. Because, you know, sometimes you wonder, is it about principle? Like, why would you put yourself through more pain? But I can't give these people an opportunity to try to say that about me. It's just not true. I can't let it happen. My children are grown. If I gotta spend the rest of my life in prison, I definitely don't want it. I don't believe it, but I can't go in there and do anything else but say the truth and be myself.
If you want to help JJ, please visit freejohnadrianvelasquez.org for more information about JJ's case, links to petitions, and ways to contact representatives. You can also find all this information on our website, unjustandunsolved.com.
Our thanks to producer Maggie Freeling for bringing us this story. It's part of her new podcast, Unjust and Unsolved, a production of the Obsessed Network. This episode was produced by Maggie Freeling and edited by Amber Hunt. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Julieta Martinelli, Alisa Escarce, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, and Reynaldo Leaños Jr., with help from Marta Martinez and Raul Perez. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw, with help from Elisheba Itu. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Julia Rocha. Our interns are Jimena del Cerro, Emil Sequiros, and Gabriela Baez. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, we'll see you on all of our social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities.